Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change the norm in this sector rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. It is my pleasure to have John Stansfield as my guest today on Making Change. John is currently the Director of Advocacy and Campaigns for Oxfam New Zealand. Prior to joining Oxfam, John's career has spanned just about every aspect of social change, from heading the Problem Gambling Foundation of New Zealand to a project he calls Guerrilla Gardening, an effort to increase local food production in his local community on Waiheke Island off the coast of Auckland. At the opposite end of all his hands-on work in social change, John also co-founded the Graduate Program in Not-for-Profit Management at New Zealand's Unitec Institute of Technology, a program that teaches hands-on nonprofit management skills in communities all across New Zealand and throughout the Pacific Islands. With his breadth of experience with successful change efforts, it is my pleasure to have John Stansfield share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is John Stansfield. John, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
One of the things that I always start by asking out is just one basic question, which is, when you see social change happening, what do you see happening that's underpinning that, the factors that are leading to social change?
Well, it's a big question. That kind of analysis happened shortly after the desperate excitement of saying, oh, there's some change, I want to get on it. I think the kind of learnings in life for me about really good social change are that there's three factors that are present. The first is some piece of very radical or novel, but not necessarily new, thinking. The second is that thought or that idea has been polished through discourse and discussion and debate to a point where it is ready for audiences. It's compelling for telling. And the third thing is that we've got it to such a stage that it looks like it's going to be fun to be with. And there's a great old community work adage that if you're fun to be with, there'll always be people with you. And you need people with you if you're going to make change.
Yeah, nobody does it on their own. Start with one of them. Tell me about what you mean, if you've got stories, examples, radical novel thinking.
Sure. I think maybe I'll start with a second case, which was the Problem Gambling Foundation of New Zealand. Problem Gambling Foundation of New Zealand is an independent, not-for-profit organization. It has an annual budget of about $5 million and 70-odd staff. And I left an academic career to lead that at a time when it was in a very powerless state. If you're going to shift out from being an academic back to running something, it's a great idea to pick something that's really broken, because if you fail to breathe life into it, it's unlikely that the blame will be attributed to you. And in this case, it was very, very broken. It was insolvent, and there was a great deal of discord in the organization, and it had some unfortunate publicity when its charismatic founder had allegedly returned to gambling, allegedly with the company checkbook, and the litigation still going on about that. So it was in a really bad way. And one of the great things about being in a bad way was it wasn't something you stepped into like stepping into a new truck and started the engine and drove off. You had to kind of fiddle about and see if you could make it run first. And in the making it run, I didn't immediately have levers I could pull which would, you know, make it turn this way and that. And so I had quite a bit of thinking time. And one of the things in that area in gambling where such a lot of the research is funded by the gambling industry is that such a lot of the research is crooked. So you can read avidly and try and learn and everything, but you really don't know whether what you're learning is straight or not. And you have to develop some theoretical frameworks about that very quickly and some friends who you can trust. So I'm reading away, and I come across this little piece of stats as I'm assembling a kind of history of gambling in New Zealand. So here we are, you know, 12 years ago, no women in New Zealand present for gambling harm.
Oh.
By 2003, you know, half of the people presenting for gambling harm are women. So the paradigm under which gambling is being examined is an addictions paradigm. And an addictions paradigm looks at the person who has been harmed after they have been harmed and said, what is the matter with that person and how do we fix it?
Right.
Right. So if you apply that lens to that bit of stats, you say, oh, sometime in the last 12 years, New Zealand women became very weak and vulnerable. Now, weak and vulnerable women in New Zealand have not, they're not a breed I've met a lot of. Mouthy, strong, stroppy, opinionated, clever, resourceful. I've met a lot of those.
It's one of the things I love about New Zealand women.
Yeah, these weak and vulnerable ones are just not on my street. So it didn't ring true to me. You know, I thought, well, what else can I learn about this? So I started to delve down into the stats, and holy moly, I found that, you know, 85% of those women had a primary problem with a single product. And when you looked at Indigenous women, it was up to 94% had a primary problem with a single gambling product, and that was what you, I think, call, or certainly in Canada, they call VLTs, I think in the States, slots.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia and New Zealand, we affectionately call them pokey machines. So hang on, what's happened? A machine has come on the market, and all of a sudden, a lot of women who touch it become harmed. So what's the matter with these women is what the paradigm is telling me. And, you know, Hildy, I think for any one of us, if we had a problem, something was harming us in life, you set us down with enough psychologists, we would find something that was broken in our psyche that might be leading to that problem.
Perhaps
we weren't breastfed as a child, or our mothers didn't love us, or, you know, some trauma had happened. But there's another way of looking at it. You know, at one part of my life, I was an industrial health and safety inspector in the baking industry. And I just looked at it, I thought, you know, if I had a baking machine that periodically tore the arms off its users, I would not sit them down in a circle and say, hi guys, let's share. What is it about us that asked us to have our arms torn off by the machines, you know?
Exactly.
Just isn't how you'd approach the problem.
Right.
And yet all of the resources in gambling harm were approaching it in precisely that way.
Yeah.
So when you look at that a little closely, you say, well, who's winning out of this? Well, my goodness, there's an industry here making a fortune out of this product, which clearly harms people. And yet we're using an addictions paradigm. And an addictions paradigm, in addition to the other points I raised, it's saying this is an abnormal outcome.
Right.
When you delve into the stats and you have a look at it, you find that 40% of the revenue going into a slot machine comes out of the pocket of somebody who has no control. So being harmed is not, you can't say 40% is abnormal. That's kind of up there in the middle of the bell curve.
Mm-hmm.
Then you find that people who regularly use a slot machine, the normal outcome for them is to become harmed. So we've got the focus in the wrong place. We're looking at the person who's being harmed. We should be looking at the machine that's doing the harm.
So when you're coming from radical and novel thinking, you're really coming to, what you're doing is you're asking a different question. You're asking an entirely different question.
That's right, and not necessarily a popular question, because you imagine yourself, you're in this organization, more than half of the staff, many counselors in the addictions field have come to their professional life via the pathway of their own demons. So you're saying to those people at the core of your organization, actually, your life experience isn't valid. That's not what's going to fix things. Makes you an enormously popular CEO on record time.
So that really then leads to polishing that idea through debate.
Yeah, And that says, so what you're then saying is, actually, of course, we must always care for people who've been harmed. That's, you know, it's basic, it's a core part of what we do, but it doesn't actually change anything. And in order to change things, this is, we're treating it as a demand-side problem, but actually this is a supply-side problem. And when you look at the supply of slot machines, you find that they are supplied to the poorest communities. That there is never any demand by those communities, please, please, come in and rape us. It just doesn't happen. And so what we have to do is we have to change the political infrastructure so that those communities can protect themselves. And that meant some legislative change and then some good, solid community organising so that communities like, for instance, South Auckland, the city, former city of Manukau, poorest city in Auckland, highest concentration of pokie machines, 8,000 of their citizens were encouraged to make an actual submission to the local government and say, we don't want these things in our street. Enormously powerful. The city of Christchurch went out to consultation on its gambling policy, got over 2,000 submissions. This is prior to the earthquake, perhaps it's what caused it. More than the Port Little Darlings had had on any other issue ever in the entire history of the city. So good, solid community organising reduces supply. That's what reduces harm.
It sounds like that's the perfect prelude to the work that you're doing right now with Oxfam.
Oh, yeah, Oxfam's the dream job. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Campaigns, so I get to do social change for a living, legitimately. I can say to Mumsy, you do get a job out of this eventually. Running a big campaign called GROW, and GROW is like our most intelligent ever approach to hunger. So Oxfam's an organisation which is concerned with poverty and justice, and we've been concerned with hunger for, you know, 70 years. If you get up really close to hunger, you can say, well, people are hungry because their lands have been stolen or their plants have been patented or climate change has made it impossible to grow or women have been denied access to agricultural land large rich countries have dumped food in their country and destroyed the local industry or their rivers have been poisoned or any one of a dozen other really good reasons.
Right.
But if you take three steps back, as that very bright 12-year-old in my house said to me, it's kind of simple, Dad. In one corner of the room, you've got all these folks with too much food, and it's making them sick. And in the other corner of the room, you've got these folks who haven't got enough food, and it's making them sick. And in the middle of the room, there's a whole lot of food going rotten, and there's enough food for everybody, but almost a billion people are going to bed hungry every night. So that is systemic failure. That's a whole food system that doesn't work. And yes, we have to address those individual up-close issues, but the very big issue is that we've lost governance of food. So food is being governed on behalf of the few. The few, the powerful, the elites do incredibly well out of food. The issue of whether you have food or don't have food is not an issue of how bright you are or how hard you work. It's an issue of power.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fundamentally a governance issue. And that means we need to start taking political action so that our political leaders understand that food is a basic human right and people being denied it is not something that we will put up with. And this has started to have some currency across the world. All of a sudden, Hillary Clinton and Sarkozy and the World Bank and leaders all over the place have got very interested in food justice because they've looked at the north of Africa and they've said, hungry people are just not that stable. It's not a great place for us to sell our stuff when they're all rioting like this. And we've had big food riots in 2008. And we're seeing them again now. So there's it's a great fight.
So when you bring together, then you're looking at that at a systemic failure at the governance level, at the power level, at the political level, which clearly is the new thinking piece. because people have been putting together the different pieces of it, whether it's the ecosystem, whether it is the poverty piece, whether it's people have been looking at the roots of it, and looking at it from the top down is a different way of looking at it. Where is the debate happening in there? Where is the community organizing coming from the bottom up?
Oh, right. Oh, well, we have got some deeply sexy tools for this. And one of them, which is the greatest social change tool I've ever sold, is called Oxfam's Biggest Coffee Break. Now, New Zealanders...
Coffee break, yeah.
So New Zealanders used to have a very strong societal value of fairness. It was one of the things that we held very dear and would have described about ourselves as a community. During the sort of 1980s period of neoliberal economic reforms, fairness was subjugated to cleverness and I can make a buck off you, Fred. And it got really very subjugated, so that as a value, it was sitting somewhere on a dusty shelf and wasn't getting a lot of exercise. Now, when you look at the food governance issue and you look at the other issues of poverty and injustice that Oxfam has to deal with, you cannot deal with those unless you're working from a values base that says we believe in fair. So we have to rehabilitate the value of fair. And one of the mechanisms that we have for that is the greatest coffee break. And the coffee break is a way of having a conversation about fair and introducing...
And I'm going to clarify for American audiences that what sounds when you're speaking like fear is actually fair.
Right. Yes,
I just want to make sure that we're not talking about a value of fear.
No, fair. Almost blonde, it's so fair. Yep.
There we go. You keep going now. I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you for that. I've made that mistake before. So what we want to do is hold a national conversation about fair and at the same time introduce people to ways of acting that are fair. Because what happens when somebody has a conversation around a value and they then act on it is that it starts to form part of identity. And so I shift from being somebody who thinks about fair to someone who believes in fair to someone who is fair and will always act fair. So that's our model of change behind it. So what happens with Coffee Break is Hildy sees our website or picks up something at a food show and says, you know, I could hold one of these coffee breaks for Oxfam, I'll do that, and registers online. And we then send you a box with fair trade coffee and fair trade chocolate and fair trade sugar and some tea and a little DVD about fair trade and some instructions on how to hold a coffee break. And you gather together a dozen or so of your friends and you say, I'm holding a coffee break. Maybe it's work, maybe it's at a church group, maybe it's at a mother's group. You know, maybe it's just a neighborhood group. And you do some baking and your friends do some baking and everyone comes together and we watch this fair trade video. Now, fair trade, of course, is a deeply subversive concept about saying, well, the market won't deliver a decent living wage to the banana farmer in Ecuador. But when you put the banana in your daughter's lunchbox, wouldn't it be a better world if you knew that the person who had grown the banana was able to send his or her daughter to school as well. And therefore, we'll go outside the market and we'll have our own system certification and we'll pay a little bit more, but we'll be confident that that's happening. So that's the fastest growing piece of merchandise, right, actually, is fair trade. So you have your coffee break, you watch your DVD, your mates all contribute a few dollars, the price of a cup of coffee, and you send it off, and then you get a feedback loop from us about, well, that was fantastic, and this is how the campaign went, and this is where you can buy fair trade goods in your neighborhood. And all that's happening on the surface. What's been happening underneath that is that a group of people have been talking about fair.
Mm-hmm.
What is fair? And they go away from it, and they're thinking about what is fair. And they go away through in a fortnight in which we deluge the media with what fair is at a level that, you know, we're monster cooking shows, all kinds of things. We have people running around the streets in gorilla suits grabbing bananas and all kinds of nutty stuff happening. But that is it's a deeply subversive act to have that conversation about fair. And we have to have that conversation, because we're never going to get to just if we haven't first got to fear.
Wow. And it is remarkably fun to be with.
Oh, I tell you.
You really hit all of the marks.
Seriously, look, I joined the organization 3 months before we did the coffee break this year, and I've done a bit of selling. I'm a confident sort of guy. I've sold social change products all my life. I went out and started to sell this thing. I could not believe it. It just flew. People said, oh, so what you want me to do this time is sit down and have some nice coffee and a cake with my friends. I think I can do that for you, Johnny.
I think I can do this. And subversively talking about fairness. This is not bad.
I don't have to chain myself to the gates of the High Court or Parliament or anything. I can sit down and have a coffee. This will work.
Well, what's clearly at the root of it, John, is not just the value of fairness, but a discussion of values overall.
Oh, yeah.
And you and I have talked a little bit about the fact that when I was in New Zealand working with the folks at Unitec, one of the exciting things that you've done in your life is you are one of the founders of the not-for-profit program at Unitec. And the thing that struck us working with the faculty there is that it is the only university-based diploma for not-for-profit or nonprofit management that we have found anywhere in the world that has at its core a teaching on values, that the 101 level program actually is values in an organization. And it's so clear that that is a thread that goes through all of the work that you're doing. Can you speak a little bit to the inclusion of values in the not-for-profit management program at Unitec?
Sure. Well, it actually was deliberate. It was by design.
Oh, sure. It would have to be.
Yes. When we look at the sectors of society, and we break them up as academics as if they're all three distinct things. They're not really. They merge together. They muddle around. But it's kind of handy for thinking. Right. So you've got the government sector, which is the state, right? Now, if the state was running the charity that I founded on Waiheke Island, Sustainability Charity, it's so simple for them. They can just go like, well, everybody who lives here will donate to this charity. We know, because we run the tax system.
Right.
And they could even pass a regulation that says you will belong to this charity. No problem. They can do that.
Right.
So they have that coercive power. If you look at the market institutions, business, etc., they have a different form of power. They can induce you to do things with a check. the great carrot, we do it. We will pay you to do this. Holy gee, I'll do that. We will pay you even more if you do it quicker. I will do it twice as quick. So they have this other form of power. And you look at the charity, and it doesn't have coercive power. And it doesn't have this kind of instrumental market power. The only power it has is a kind of a normative power. You'll do this because it's the right thing. And the right thing is really a kind of a consensus-based tool. So the smartest things in not-for-profit that I ever see when there's very strong alignment between the values of the organization and the values of the people working in it. So people come to join the organization because they know what it believes, and that's who they are. That's what I believe as well. So we used to say, at the very base, community organizations have a single competitive advantage, just one, and that is the ability to excite in people a passion around the exercise of shared values. So, and that's what begets voluntarism. People do not go and volunteer for AT&T. It just doesn't happen. And it's what begets philanthropy. People do not write out their paychecks and say, I'm going to give half mine to General Motors. But they do that for community organizations. And they do that because we've excited in them a passion around a value that we share. And the most important kind of function that comes out of that is a sense of belonging. And belonging is the most, in my view, the most important thing that a community organisation does. It's not any of the instrumental stuff of providing housing and shelter and food and all those other things. It's actually about belonging. It's the one thing that we never measure, that no one funds us to do, but is probably more important than anything else. And I've debated this with people. I said, if you don't believe me, go to court. Go to the criminal court on a Monday morning and clock out how many people look like they're belonging, because they're not. You won't find the sports coach in the criminal court on Monday morning. You won't find the people who are connected up. So belonging is the connected upness. And you say of community organisations, they are the crucible of democracy, the place where people come together to share their dreams and plan their common futures. Now, all of that has to rest on a core of values which are aligned. It just doesn't work as simply if people aren't believing the same stuff.
Well, and it leads back to all of the things that you mentioned when we first started talking. The values will be the thing that's going to undergird whatever that novel idea is. Whatever, because a novel idea in a business is just going to lead to profit. But when you're talking about a novel idea being at the underpinnings of social change, that idea is going to be rooted in values.
And if you think of the Problem Gambling Foundation, the real value that was underpinning that was a sense of justice and fairness. And when you put that lens on and you analyse that industry, what you saw was, this is a deeply regressive thing. It is a transfer of wealth from the women to the men, from the brown to the white, from the poor to the rich. When you expressed it in that way, it transgressed Kiwi values so very strongly that it was possible to get change. Mm-hmm. But until you were able to move it from poor, poor, pitiful Hildy, you know, she's blown a rent check on the pokey machines again, there's no real driver for change in that. But if you say this industry...
Well, what were the results... Sure. Well, I'm sorry, John. I'm curious what the results were that you saw after coming to that change of mindset and bringing together people around that. What were the results that you saw with the Problem Gaming
Inside
Foundation?
The organization itself, we had a pretty tough period of swallowing this new paradigm. But when people were given some time with it, and some people just left, it was too hard, you know, it was just too compromising for them. Mm-hmm. But given some time with it to test it out and to polish the sound bites and polish the ideas and discussion, and they began to articulate it in their own words. I still have a DVD of a wonderful hui that we had at Takaparawha Marae, the big Bastion Point Marae in Auckland, where the staff were starting to talk about this idea in their own words, and it was very, very powerful, and it became central to who we were. Now, that led us to think very strategically about how do you shift that message out, one step out. And I remember sitting with Bill Bradford, who was our journalist and PR guy and make stuff happen dude, and saying, Billy, you know, I don't have television, so I've got no idea what's on it. What's on it? And he said, it's kind of simple. It's mostly hospitals and sex and crime. And I said, it's going to be hard to make this.
That's why you don't have TV.
Make this into a hospitals or a sex story. What does it look like in terms of crime? And we started to study it. And we found that a terrific amount of crime was gambling fueled. And so we started to push that message out amongst the public. And we started to dig an ambulance chase every time we saw a fraud case and do some poking around and find out if gambling was involved. And it was involved at just an enormous amount of the time. And as we started to uncover how big that scandal was, and create some real and repetitive news media about it, we effected a very significant change in public opinion. So whereas when gambling had been about poor, poor, pitiful Hildy, you know, she's lost the rent check, people were kind of a bit sad for her, but basically, you know, it's nothing to do with me. It's not going to hurt me. when it was the next time your house gets burgled, it's going to be because someone has a gambling problem. The next time your accountant rips off the business, that'll be because someone has a gambling problem. We found through repetitive and very high-level research by Ernst & Young that the most likely cause of fraud in charitable organisations was someone's got a gambling problem. And the second highest cause of white-collar fraud overall in the economy is someone's got a gambling problem. However, when you resort that by size, so you just take the top 100 big cases, it's almost always someone's got a gambling problem. So you start telling that story, and all of a sudden it's not about poor, poor, pitiful Hildy. It's about, hell, this is hurting me.
Right.
This is hurting my kids. You know, I'm paying for all this stuff. And that effected a change where the latest government surveys now, completely independently of us through the internal affairs and health departments, are saying, the majority of Kiwis are saying, gambling does more harm than good, and funding charities through gambling is just not good enough. It doesn't work. We're not happy with it. So that's driving a reduction in supply and driving pressure on lawmakers to continue to reduce supply. And I think it's kind of unstoppable now.
And how long a period did this take?
I always think that, you know, to appreciate social change, you should have the time sense of a geologist. But this was remarkably fast. We got the first law change through in 2003, and it was a very compromised law change. And that was the same year that we were re-engineering the foundation. And we had a new paradigm well and truly launched by the end of the first quarter of 2004. And we were getting very big change in reported public opinion in, you know, third-party surveys by 2007. So, yeah, pretty quickly.
It's been really interesting. One of the things that we found in the work we're doing at Creating the Future is that when we change the way we see things, one of the things that change, because when you change how you see things, everything changes. And one of the things that we're still surprised, it's so funny, we've been doing this work for over 10 years, and we're still surprised every time it happens, because culturally you're so used to the assumption that change will happen slowly. And we repeatedly find that when people put that big radical idea first and they realign their thinking behind it and realign their planning and all of their doing behind it, that it happens just as fast as you're talking about, and that that's consistent. And we just assume it's going to be slow, and every single time we're blown away at how fast
it happens. We were lucky. I was challenged by a big philanthropist, but really a very big businessman in New Zealand, called Stephen Tindall, who I've done sort of pro bono work for his philanthropic organisation for years, and I admire the work they do. But he said to me, well, so what's your big, hairy, audacious goal? And I took that back to my management team, and we'd been very influenced by the kind of moderate and meek voice of the Ministry of Health that had, you know, relatively modest goals. And my team came back and said, well, our job is to eliminate gambling harm. That's the job. Mm. Let's get on with that job.
Yep.
And that was really quite transformative.
Yeah, and once that's what you're aiming at, and you're actually not aiming at it with lip service, but you're actually aiming at it with your day-to-day, it happens so quickly. I'm thrilled to hear your story.
It's been a lot of fun. I think the other revolution that we've got happening in New Zealand at the moment, I don't know how it plays out where you live, but we're very involved with it, is a revolution around food and people wanting to be more connected with their food. And at a very local level, I'm having a terrific amount of good social change fun around that. We have a guerrilla gardening movement, which identifies bits of public land that's not being used for anything, and then we come on in the middle of the night with a rotary hoe and put it into food crops.
Oh, goodness.
We've put food gardens into all the schools. there are fruit trees are mysteriously appearing all over the place.
I didn't know they did that.
It's great fun. and we've got a whole renaissance of home food production. And I came to this largely because my now 12-year-old daughter at 8 said to me when we shifted into the village off the farm, I'm going to miss us, you know, having the farm. We've still got the farm, honey. Yeah, but, you know, Dad, I'm going to miss it. I want you to make this into our farm. It's a small suburban lot on a main street. And so we decided we wouldn't have a lawn, that every bit of ground would be cultivated for food. And we put 30-odd fruit trees onto it, and we've got, you know, corn and beans and melons and squash and all kinds of stuff. It had the most interesting, unexpected effect, and that is it just challenged the hell out of everyone, because you're supposed to have a neat little manicured lawn. And here's this kind of food jungle. And people would be talking about it loudly at 6 o'clock in the morning, standing at the bus stop, talking about the corn. Cars would stop in the middle of the main street, and people would get out and walk up the driveway to look at all this food growing. And it just started this whole conversation in our community, which has been a great, and continues to be, a great source of fun and food.
You know, it's something that I share with you. I have been blogging for years about the fact, because for 20 years I've had a garden in my front yard, and I have been blogging for many years about the fact that gardening in the front yard is all about community engagement. And it's quite a metaphor, because it really is what you guys are talking about in everything else that you've been doing, John, is really metaphorically gardening in the front yard is being out there in terms of changing the debate and how we talk about things, but doing it by engaging people right where they are, whether it's at their coffee break, in their garden,
That's
in their
right.
front yard.
You get into it first.
Well, John, I could just talk with you all day long, and I hope sometime soon that we will do this again. But thank you so much for sharing everything with us and for being with us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Speaking with John, it's clear that the thread running through all his efforts is not just the radical idea he spoke of as we began the interview. It's really the values at the heart of each of those ideas, the things we hold dear. Whether it was the work of the Problem Gambling Foundation or the work he's doing with Oxfam, the issues of fairness and justice are the touchstones that have led those efforts to create change. If John's assessment is true, and I believe that it is, that community organizations are places where people share their dreams and plan their common futures, then John's other observation is equally true, that community organizations' key advantage is their ability to excite passion around shared values. Shared dreams and shared values go hand in hand. And so it makes sense that when we're explicit about our shared values, naming them and building upon them, that we can expect to see similar results as John witnessed, and that we see repeatedly at Creating the Future. It's not just that change happens when we build upon those shared values. It's that it happens with remarkable speed and grace. Yes, taking on the powers that be about food inequity may seem daunting and overwhelming. And yes, talking about the shared value of fairness during coffee breaks all across the country, that may seem more doable. But when a whole nation begins talking all at once about the shared value of fairness and justice, well, the change that initially seemed daunting suddenly seems inevitable. Which leads to questions for your own work. What values are your own programs built upon? Are those values explicitly stated to create touchstones for everyone involved? Are you using those shared values to create lasting, systemic change? In our own work at Creating the Future, one of the most powerful questions we've encountered is one you can use at your board meetings and staff meetings and everywhere people are working together. And that question is this: what evidence have you seen of our values in action? What would your values look like in action with the receptionist, with your volunteers, with your board members? As you begin exploring the values at the core of your own organization's work, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or at the Chronicle's Making Change group at LinkedIn. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.